I only write a bit of the final work of art. But sometimes when you can really see that these words spoken by, it could be Cisse in Borgen, at that time set in motion by all these amazing people, then I can be very touched.
That was Adam Prise, and this is Nordic Portraits. Adam Prise is a screenplay writer, playwright, restaurateur, and TV chef who burst onto the international scene in 2010 with the Danish political drama Born, or Borgen, a DR series that won him a BAFTA award and was subsequently sold to over 90 countries. Adam is also a major figure in the Scandinavian culinary world, having, together with older brother James, hosted and produced 14 successful seasons of the television program Spise med Prise. Adam, welcome to Nordic Portraits.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Adam, I wondered if we could start by going back to 2007, when on an autumnal evening in Copenhagen, you found yourself at the gym noticing a TV screen in the background where the then Prime Minister, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, made an announcement. And I just wondered what happened next.
Well, it's absolutely true. I wanted to do a series of political fiction. And this event that you're describing happened just after I made the worst pitch in my career. I basically said, I would like to do something about politics. So a series on Danish coalition politics. And they just sat there and watched me, DR. And they said, well, you might want to work on that pitch. And naturally, I had to do that. I had to kind of focus my idea and actually find the passion for a certain direction in the political fiction. So I was standing in my local fitness center next to a big muscular guy. And just as you said, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the former prime minister, announced the election. And I thought, well, this is actually the heyday. This is the party day of democracy, right? This is where actually there's a date announced where we get to decide. Amazing. And then that great big muscular guy next to me said, fuck, count me out. And then he just left. And I just thought immediately that was the idea. The angle for Borgen appeared in that moment because I thought, what the hell? I mean, we were about the same age, and I grew up with very strong images of people fighting for democracy, like the falling of the Berlin Wall or the rebellion on the Tiananmen Square, where people actually died in order to get an election, you know, actually being able to vote. And I thought, hey, in this country, we have one of the oldest and most well-functioning democracies on the planet, but we don't even bother to vote anymore. So if I could make that guy interested in politics, then it would surely be a successful project. And that was my goal. You know, I was saying, well, we have this expression in Denmark that we call people like him sofa voters. Yeah. And I just thought, if I can turn this sofa voter into a citizen, that was my new pitch. So let's turn the sofa voters into participating citizens. And that was almost, you know, a public service idea that we could, in a way, combine telling people about democracy, telling them about our system in Denmark, and at the same time, really stir a political interest. And of course, that had to be done through identification in characters. The characters are everything. This idea is basically just a structural format or an angle to a story, but it doesn't make us feel anything. So the characters were, of course, the next job that waited for me. But that was actually the pitch moment for Borgen when that guy said, fuck, count me out.
Well, you were successful in converting these, as you say, sofa voters into active, interested partakers of democracy. But at what point did you realize that you suddenly had an international hit on your hands? And how surprised were you that a story so intrinsically connected to the Danish political system would travel so well?
Well, we were astonished, all of us that were kind of on the bridge of the show. Also because the former head of drama, Mr. Ingolf Gabold, who was the head of drama during the first seasons of Borgen, he actually called us into his office and said, we were three writers at the time, and he said, guys, I just have to break this to you. Don't expect this to travel, ever. Because it is basically, even though Adam made the pitch slightly better, it is still a show about Danish coalition politics. And who on earth would want to watch this? Maybe the Danes. Let's hope that. Maybe the Swedes and Norwegians out of brotherly love or something like that. But it will end there, definitely. So we were really told to curb our enthusiasm, lower our expectations, and don't believe that anyone else but the Danes would possibly watch this. Then a few things happened that kind of hinted at a possible other ending to this project, because we actually won the Prix Thalia before the show even opened on Danish television. It was sent there basically by DR, I think almost just like business as usual. Hey, what do we have in the drama department? Oh, we have this political show. Let's just shove it to Italy and see what happens. And actually won for drama. And we were kind of, oh, well, that's a very nice award. Thank you so much. Then it became kind of a moderate success in Denmark, because the general public, the viewers of DR, they actually loved the show, but it was killed in the press, which is quite interesting, because now the show is almost like sacrosanct. Now it's, oh, Borgen, well, that's one of the great Scandinavian shows and blah, blah, blah. But I have to say, the leading Danish papers like Politiken, Berlingske, the big papers, they actually killed the first season pretty badly. I mean, we were roughed up. And I remember also, because we had very young actors on the show, people that were not very experienced. So like Pilou Asbæk back then, he's now world star. Birgitte Hjort Sørensen, also an international star. But back then, it was their first major role, you know. So they were really messed up about it. They were so sad. And I had to say, well, guys, just look at Facebook, look at the general public. They actually love the show. And we have a lot of viewers. And we get high reviews, not from the press, but actually from the general public. So it was a moderate success in Denmark. Then all of a sudden, because I think we were standing on the shoulders of a show like The Killing, it was huge in the UK. And it actually also became quite big in most of Europe, actually. And I think that possibly made the Brits say, well, now there's a political show. Let's just see what it is. And it became so popular. And also it rode on the wave of Nordic noir. Also, it was kind of mentioned in the British press as yet another example of Nordic noir, which is not at all. Because, I mean, we don't have dead girls in forests. We have very live politicians in offices, you know. So we're quite far away from classical Nordic noir. But still, and then a few other awards came by and we were kind of, what? What is happening? And we read reviews and we were accustomed to the Danish reviews that were not very good, you know. So all of a sudden, we read reviews from The Guardian, The Times, the German papers. They loved it in the Netherlands and in Belgium also. All over Europe, they were really so happy for the show. And then we won the BAFTA, and it became huge. I think The Guardian devoted, you know, a section of the paper for every episode. I went over to the UK on a press tour. It was amazing. And we won also the Peabody Award in the States. So I went to New York and received a prize there. And we won so many different prizes. So we were incredibly grateful and astonished because of that kind of weak start in Denmark. But then a huge international wave of success. And then, funnily enough, then the Danish press all of a sudden rediscovered the show and began to mention it as that great political show from Denmark or our own backyard, forgetting that they might not have liked the show very much when it opened.
That raises the question then, do you pay close attention to criticism? Did it in any way inform your writing of further episodes and seasons of the show at all? Or did you just dismiss it entirely and choose to back yourself in?
Well, I kind of dismissed it. I wouldn't necessarily dismiss every piece of criticism I received. I think basically when you write a thing like a television series, you write it very much in a process of constant criticism from your peers, from the actors, from the production, from the director, from all corners of the production. You get criticism. Then you turn in another draft. They will criticize that for different reasons, hopefully. And then slowly you get better and better. So I think TV fiction is very much done through a process that turns around criticism, good constructive criticism. So normally I would read reviews because you might actually get to know your show in a different way. But this particular criticism that hit Borgen had very much to do about realism, and I thought they were completely oblivious to the facts of fiction, basically, that you have to simplify, that you have to cut down the number of characters. If you want to do something which is one-to-one realism, do a documentary. I mean, do something else, but don't do drama, because you cannot have a meaningful emotional response to 55 characters. You know, it's just not possible. And the level of realism I think we achieved was adequate, I think, because fiction, it looks like reality, it looks like the real life, but it is anything but that. It is the most artificial thing you can do, possibly. Every single turning point has been thought over and has been constructed mechanically in a writer's room and on the set and finally in the editing room. So it's so artificial. And I thought they were completely, they didn't know the process and they criticized it for all the wrong reasons. So basically the criticism of Borgen in the Danish press in the beginning, we just said to the actors, don't read it because they're not right. You are actually. And we could see that we gained so much popularity in the general public, and all of a sudden you get emails from Israel or Japan, people going, we love the show, please, when there's new season arriving. We were just like, okay, I think we are onto something here and we shouldn't listen to the criticism.
I love the passion with which you talk about fiction and the construction of a story. And if we go all the way back to your childhood, it seems by no coincidence that you've landed in this position. Your father, John, your mother, Birgitta, were both actors. In your father's case, also a director and a theater director, and in your mother's case as well, in her latter years.
Yes.
What are your memories of growing up in a family where both parents were so invested in their own careers in the arts?
Well, just as you said, from very early on, I knew that my parents did something extraordinary, that it was not a normal job, and our day-to-day life was different than my friends at school, because my parents worked in a different way. They left the house around 6 PM and they didn't come back until when we slept. You know, we were brought up by them, but very much also by a nanny. And it was a privileged childhood in a house where the arts was very much what we talked about always. Basically, we always make fun of it, my brother and I, and said we basically talked about two things in our childhood, drama or theater, and food. That was basically it. Because my father was also very much into food. He was quite famous in Denmark for being a gourmet. And it was kind of a side career for him to write in glossy magazines, recipe articles and stuff like that. So, I mean, basically what we ate interested us so much. And we traveled for amazing restaurants and always discussed what was on the plate, what we were going to eat the next time. And then we discussed their work, naturally. And it was the great theater classics. It was opera. It was once in a while musical, but it was very much centered around plays. So I grew up with all these amazing playwrights, listening to their words and seeing my parents on stage. So we were brought to the theater and we saw every single thing they did. Also things that we were not able to understand. I mean, when you were 5 and you watch your first play by Beckett, it's pretty weird. It's even weird now. but it was a gift, a true gift, and I'm ever so grateful. And of course, my career is not very spectacular, or I'm not someone that has broken some kind of sociological pattern by becoming something completely else than my parents. parents because I'm basically doing the same thing. And the family was known as Price. We come from the UK and we have been basically standing on stages doing various kinds of things. Some were artists, circus artists. Some were actors, some were dancers, some were singers. But for 300 years, we've been doing the same thing.
Well, is it true that you can trace your family history all the way back to Thomas Price, who was a publican in the early 1700s in London, holding court with the locals as quite a storyteller himself?
Yes. He was a pub keeper, a pub owner in London. He owned a very popular place called the Farthing Pie House, and his son didn't take over the business. His son actually became the first artist in the family. He became Riding Master John Price. So he must have been able to ride in a spectacular way. That was basically when it all began. And it was James the First that in the 1780s left London and traveled slowly up through Europe and arrived in Denmark and then forced his way into, you know, the walled city of Copenhagen. Because I'm sure the artists back then, the privileged artists that were allowed to perform within the walls, they were very protective about these rights. So it was difficult to get permission. And we actually have his very beautifully written documents for the king, the letters for the king, saying, oh, please, my lord, could you ever bestow upon me the great honor of being able to perform within the city walls of Copenhagen? Naturally, he didn't write them himself. He went to a scribe, I'm sure, because he didn't speak Danish. So he must have gone to a scribe that spoke English and said, hey, you have to help me. And we have all these letters, and finally he gets permission, and he opens his first theater in 1802 or 3. Then the part of the family where I come from actually were the traveling Prices that went to all over Europe and also to the Russian Tsar and performed there as circus artist. And then actually my father was the first one that settled in Copenhagen. So the branch of the family that we come from, we are actually second generation immigrants. And basically to live up to the tradition of the Price family, he was put in ballet school at the Royal Theatre. And he actually was a ballet pupil for the first 8 years of that school. Then they kicked him out. And they still actually do that. You know, the Royal Ballet School, they have a very strict discipline. And every year you are tested for your talent as a dancer. And they kicked him out also because he looked different. He looked foreign. He looked Italian or French. And he didn't live up to the ideals of the beautiful Scandinavian tall ballet dancer at the time. So they kicked him out. Then he went to the open audition for the Royal Theatre School. Tested his luck, and the rest is history. He stayed there for the next 70 years. But my childhood was, of course, basically rooted in the fact that my father was a very well-known actor. So was my mother. And my brother was very, very good at music and basically ended up being a composer. And I tried my luck studying law first and had 4 years as a law student. But at the same time, I couldn't help feeling a bit envious. You know, for my brother, he got to work with my parents because of the music. He became, you know, band leader or conductor or pianist for many of their shows. So they got to work together. And I was going to be a lawyer. And I thought, well, this is nice. It's interesting. But still, this is what my tribe does, you know. My tribe for 300 years, we've been actors and line dancers and circus artists and ballet dancers and everything. And I'm supposed to be a lawyer. And then I began working, you know, basically financing my studies, writing bits and pieces of shows. And we have this very popular format in Denmark called revue, which is basically, I think you would call the pantomime or something like that, where we ridicule trends and politicians and whatever happens in society. And we have these summer pantomimes, very popular in Denmark. And I began to work there because my brother also did. I wrote the odd text, song, whatever. And then I made the final decision of becoming a writer after DR, the Danish broadcasting company, offered me a contract of 6 months writing a satirical show, also basically ridiculing politicians. So I began my, you could say, my political writing career quite early, but I didn't know it would end up writing Borgen, you know. But I was offered a 6-month contract and I was 23 and I thought, now's the time. I can test if I can actually make a living out of this. And if not, I'll go back to law.
Even earlier than that, is it true that you received your own Remington typewriter at the age of 12 or 13?
Absolutely. Yes.
And you embraced this as an opportunity to explore storytelling.
Yeah, definitely. I got this and I thought it was amazing. I mean, it was, I'm so old. It was before computers. Yeah, I'm saying it. So I got this travel Remington and I loved it. And my brother and I began to write stories to each other. You know, just like that childish game of when you draw, one will draw a head, the next one will draw the upper body and another one would draw the legs and you would end up with a funny drawing. We began writing stories in the same manner. So we would write like 10 lines and you would only get to see the last line, which might be hinting at a completely different genre than the top part of the story. And then we would meet and read them and we would die laughing, of course, because the story didn't fit at all. And it was very funny. And then I began to write a bit longer pieces. I always loved when we had kind of a free format writing in school, when we were basically just told to go and write a story. I loved that. I've always been extremely interested in storytelling. I'm sure because my father was a great storyteller, so was my mother. And I watched them on stage where they basically, as actors, were telling a story.
Hmm. You say it jokingly, but with your brother, it was a collaboration. Mm. And I'm just curious because it seems that you've craved collaboration throughout your journey. Can you take us a little bit into the dynamics of a writer's room? It's something that we don't know much about. And I'm just curious, when you embark on a new project, what that is like, having sparring partners, how you are with constantly receiving criticism. What do you like and dislike about the mechanics of that relationship?
Well, I think that drama writing, especially a format like TV series, is very much something you do together with a bunch of people. It is such a huge undertaking to do a television series. It's not something you do alone. But back in the day, when I began writing, even though it was different formats, back in the late 80s and early 90s, Denmark was in the middle of a, I would say, almost a TV series crisis. They were just slaughtered in the press. They were very bad. And I think basically people at DR, the Danish National Broadcasting Company, they were thinking, how the hell do the Americans and the Brits do it? And they decided to study the Americans. So they sent over to the States a few producers actually to study how the Americans did big shows like Stephen Bochco shows like NYPD Blue and also Hill Street Blues and stuff. And they got back and they said, Eureka, we know now that they actually have something they call a head writer. They actually have a creator and he or she has a writer's room. Are you writing this down, people? It's a writer's room. And in this room are writers. And they will discuss the stories together and they will work on whiteboards or notepads. And then one of the staff writers probably will be sent home to write an episode. Are you getting this, people? And constantly being watched or read and criticized by the creator. The creator will probably write the first, maybe even the first and second episode to kind of set the tone of the show. And then I think we got the idea and slowly by slowly, a Danish or Scandinavian version of this American method of writing basically was set in motion. It happened, you know, over the course of several series. And I happened to be on one of the first of what we would call the new but now classical wave of Danish TV shows, a show called Taxa in Danish, about a cab company, basically. That was where I learned the craft. I didn't know any of the mechanics of storytelling for TV. I learned them by doing them, basically, together with people that were much more experienced. than I was, because I haven't gone to film school. I don't have any formal education of what I'm actually doing, you know. So I learned it by doing it. Basically, what we in Danish call mesterlære, mastering the craft with a master artist. So I learned from people that were very, very good at what they were doing, and in my parents' generation, most of them. And some of them are still active, and I'm eternally grateful, because it was a great way of learning. Because I think the problem for many young writers today is that it is so difficult to arrive at the point where you actually get to see your things produced. So you end up writing stuff that will never be produced, and maybe that gives you too much expectation of what your career is supposed to look like, and soon it will be my day when my first thing will be produced. For me, it wasn't a big thing, because I was just in it, and I wrote a script, and it was not as good as it was supposed to, and I got criticism, and I wrote it again, and when I did the third draft, then the creator would take over, typically, and do his or her write-throughs two or three times, and then it would be produced. And more or less, it's the same method that we are using today. I must say that for the latest season of Borgen, the writer's room has been very small. We have only been three people in it. Sometimes it's a bit bigger, but we don't in Denmark have tradition for these huge writer's rooms that they have in the States. We don't have the economical means to do it, basically. So typically we have a writer's room of four, maximum five writers. And naturally the creator should have an idea, and the idea should have been tested, obviously, by the production company, by the television channel, the streaming service. And then you write the first couple of episodes. You should also have naturally an idea about the first season, basically where it begins or where it ends. I always have that, because I can't write an episode if I don't know the general direction. But I think that can differ from writer to writer. So I would always know, okay, we're moving from idealism over pragmatism to cynicism. Let's just say that's such a development. And then I would space out, okay, how many episodes do we have? I know we will open here, we will end here. Okay, now we will see what episodes do we need to take our main character through this development. And naturally, you have developed all the characters, the side characters. So you have a very, you could say you have a mechanical plot in every episode, which in the case of Borgen is naturally a political case of some sort. And then you have all the private stuff, which is very often where you get the meaningful emotional response. The fascination plot, or the mechanical political plot, is what drives the story. But the emotions, the true emotions, are always found in the character's emotional life, private life, most certainly. So that is basically how we work. And as a creator, and I've been a creator now for, I think, 20, 25 years, I should, of course, have a very clear idea of what is this story about, what is the premise, what are the characters, what development are we going into in the first and in the second season, if they order more than one season, which is highly unlikely now. But still, I would know all this before I even bother to call in staff writers. And we will probably have a couple of weeks of just discussing before we actually begin to write. And then we would probably, if it's a format like Borgen, we would spend about 2 weeks doing an episode on the boards. Then we would move to treatment. And of course, already on the level of treatment, the production gets to criticize, gets to give notes, basically. And they would say, oh, it's impossible to do those three scenes in a forest, because we're actually doing a lot of stuff at the harbor. Could you move it from the forest to the harbor, please? Or the actress playing the mother is not able to be there at the same time as the actor playing the prime minister's assistant. So those two scenes you will have to change, because they cannot be there at the same time. All kinds of, you know, little practical stuff. Also, you know, big true criticism on the character level. But you have to mix all this together, and then, okay, we'll do another draft correcting this. Then comes the draft where we actually give it to the actors, only the main actors. So in this new season of Borgen, Cissé Babette playing the prime minister, or the Birgitte Nyborg, the foreign minister, and Katrine Fønsmark played by Birgitte Hjort Sørensen, and also Mikkel Bo Følsgaard playing Asger Kierkegaard, the Arctic ambassador. They are the three main actors. They will get to read a couple of drafts that they are able to give notes, and I would correct them. And then we arrive at the day of the reading, which is also a super important moment, where all the actors are called together and we read the full episode. We discuss it and I answer questions about typically research and the political elements of the story and how that fits together and where we are going in the next couple of episodes, so people actually get an idea that they're participating in something which is a meaningful arc of a story. And then they move on to the set. And now my work is done for that script, because one thing that we don't do, if you look at the American system and the Scandinavian version of that system, one problem I think there is with the American system is that the writers are always on set. And they are actually super powerful on that set. They are able to even stop the shooting and actually say, could you please remove the hat? We don't like the mother's hat. Or have you checked that suit or that dress with the creator? Because I don't think he or she will like it. And stuff like that. I mean, we would, in this country and in the Scandinavian countries, we have this, what we call the flat structure of decision, which is also the way we typically run our companies and make political decisions. Of course, there's a boss, but still you're always in some kind of discussion where you also challenge the idea of the boss. And they're not used to that. In the States, they are more hierarchical. And they would say, if the creator doesn't like the dress goes, always. And the director has not a say in that. We want to work with the best directors, and I couldn't work with the best directors if I constantly changed their decisions and were on set with them. And are you sure that psychological argument you just made for the actor, I disagree, it would be a nuisance for them. So I tend to stay away from the set. On the set, the director is God, basically, and he or she will call me if they're in doubt. Then we meet in the editing room. And that is, you have this classical saying that a story for cinema or for the television is written three times. First in the script, the second time on set, and the third time in the editing room. So that is where we basically end the story together. That's where we sit, the producer, the director, and maybe one or two of the writers, and myself as the creator. And again, I don't believe in ruling by the number of stars on your shoulder. I believe in the best argument. Naturally, as a creator, I need to know the general direction of the story, and we have to agree on that. So that's the only time where I would actually insist that my ideas were the right ideas, because if not, then the whole world will kind of disintegrate. If I all of a sudden left my premise or left the general structure of the story. So there I will be very firm, but I'm very open for discussion on scene level and character development. We will look at that. We will discuss it. And we have already at this point discussed it so much during 3-4 drafts of the script, and also possibly through a couple of calls from set to the writer's room where they said, well, doing this scene now with the mother, it's a bit complicated the way they arrive at this argument. Could you possibly think of a different way? The actor would very much like that. So it's a constant discussion. Also, you know, we like talking in these countries, and we believe in the flat structure here in Scandinavia.
Mm. One of your very successful follow-ups to Borgen has been the critically acclaimed Hans Vi. Mm. Or Ride Upon the Storm.
Yeah.
I'm really curious as to what compelled you to take on the subject of faith, diving into this world of the state church, Folkekirche, religion. Yeah. After previously having spent so much time investigating the world of politics, what drew you to that subject matter?
Well, of course, it's yet another institution that I kind of take on as a huge challenge. I've always been very challenged by the concept of faith. I find it hugely interesting. I think Christopher Hitchens, one of my great heroes, said, it's the most interesting subject there is. And I would agree, I think, with him on that. He was a great atheist, and I believe myself to be an atheist also, but I'm an atheist open for discussion. And I've always wanted to understand faith, get behind faith, because, you know, faith is something that guards, sometimes even rules, the lives of billions of people on this planet. Every day it affects choices that people are making every single day, billions of people. Those choices are very often rooted in faith, religious faith. And yet it is so intangible. We cannot prove the existence of God, and we atheists cannot prove that he or she or it doesn't exist. And there you have it. The argument stands there and will probably never change, because how should we ever be able to prove the existence of God or the non-existence of God? So I wanted to get behind that. And I also have the greatest respect for people of faith. I just very firmly believe in the fact that faith should never be imposed on people. Faith is a private matter. And a thing like state religion, even though we have a state church in Denmark, we don't force this religion on anyone. And some would even argue that the state church, to a certain extent, is disintegrating, or it is very much challenged by our modern lifestyle, and the number of members are actually diminishing. But I wanted to get behind faith and trying to understand faith. It was a survey into the most intangible and greatest subject, faith.
And as part of that survey, I believe you invited people of various walks of faith into the writer's room.
Yeah.
I'm just curious what you discovered, what surprised you about those conversations?
Well, what probably astonished me the most, and of course, I have to underline the fact that I am an atheist and the show didn't make me a believer, you know, but I was very amazed by the strength of faith I met in some of the people that actually came to the writer's room. And it was very beautiful. And I kind of, the thing is of being an atheist, that you are kind of lost in space, you know, because if there's no God, if there's no direction other than our common humanity and our way of trying to survive, and doing the least damage possible to the planet and to the living creatures on it. But you are very much alone in the universe without God. I mean, it must be so nice to have him around. And I don't know if I'm right. As said before, we cannot prove the existence or the non-existence of God. And I just have to say that the people I met of strong faith, they had this calmness about them. That they just knew that they were here for a purpose, and that every day was meaningful to them in a special way, because they sensed that security, that beauty, a faith that was never ending and constantly evolving, and that dialogue with a universal will that was here before us and will be here for eternity. And that was very beautiful. It also astonished me what people were able to discard from our world of science in order to believe in God. I must say that astonished me so much. I was sitting one day with the chairman of what we call the Inner Mission Church in Denmark, which is, you could say, a radical branch of Christianity. They are actually part of the state church in Denmark. Some of them are anyway. And he said, in the course of the conversation, he was the nicest guy. But he said, well, you know, we believe, and the circle around me in this part of the church, we believe in a young earth. And I said, well, how young? Less than 10,000 years. And I was just dropped my jaw. And I was just like, so you believe that the planet Earth is less than 10,000 years old? Oh, yes. Well, how do you account for geological finds and the fact that we kind of out of a thousand scientific reasons know that this planet was probably formed about 4.5 billion years ago. Well, Well, it is what he wants us to believe, because he wants to hide the mystery of creation for us. Okay, you seriously believe that? That hundreds of branches of science, they are all being deceived by this will of you. And I then remembered Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist and professor from the UK. He was once asked that beautiful question, Professor Dawkins, what will you say if you, after you die, wake up and see the face of God? What will you say to him? What will be your first sentence? And Dawkins answers the most beautiful answer. He said, I would say, my Lord, why did you keep it a secret? I just love that. So, and my question for this very, very strong believer was the same. Why do you think he would keep it all a secret? I mean, what would be the point?
Yeah.
So, so interesting. So I really feel as if I got very much behind faith, into faith. And I have near and dear friendships with strong believers that I have back from the day. And I also wrote most of the show together with a great writer, Karina Damm, who is one of the few actually a true Christian and a writer at the same time. So that was very beautiful, a very beautiful experience. And I'm very grateful for it.
Mm. One thing that struck me when watching Ride Upon the Storm, especially now taking into account the fact that you're a self-proclaimed atheist, is that there's no real sense of cynicism in your writing. From Borgen to Rauner Rock, your stories tend to have an optimistic tone.
Yeah.
Is this something that you're conscious of when you're writing, or do you think it's just an extension of who you are and how you see the world?
Well, I'm sure that's a personality trait. I guess I am an optimist. Also, on behalf of this planet, we have almost destroyed, and on behalf of humanity that has basically destroyed it and sometimes very much tried to destroy ourselves, you know. But still, I do believe in common humanity. I believe that we will come out victorious, even though we are so tremendously foolish. I believe in a new tomorrow. I believe in the sunrise of tomorrow. And I will always try to throw in a little flicker of light. Just as you say, in everything I write, there will always be a flicker of hope somewhere, even though it's quite dark. And I think that you mentioned Ride Upon the Storm. I think elements of that show was probably the darkest I've ever written. But still, there is this little flicker. There is hope in the world. And that is because I think there is hope in me.
I wondered if we could talk just briefly about Spise Me Prise.
Of course.
The very successful television program that you have co-created and hosted with older brother James for the past 14 seasons.
14 seasons. It's completely amazing. It astonishes also ourselves, because we didn't think when we began that show that we would get more than one season. We didn't even know that we were supposed to host the show. We contacted DR, I think, 12 years ago, saying that, hey, we write about food. I was a food critic back then, and my brother James, he wrote recipe articles just like our father did. And so we kind of knew food, and we loved food, and it was a great passion for us, and we also had done interviews and bits and pieces about food. So we basically wrote them a program proposal saying that we would like to be participating possibly as gastronomical advisors or editors for a new cooking show. And we came out to this meeting and they listened to the crazy story of food in our family that basically were brought up on two subjects, theater and food. And they said, well, guys, you have to host it. And then they had this, you know, small sister channel to the main channel, DR2, and that back in the day, it was like the crazy idea room of DR. A lot of people actually got to go in there, design a program that would never have been designed for the main channel, because you have all these expectations and you have numbers of viewers and segmentation and all kinds of stuff for a serious channel. But those goals, they were not the primary objective for that channel. It was basically originality. So crazy shows came to be about, and some of them are still there. And we are just one of them, because we combined cooking with our brotherly teasing humor and our love of food, but also our twisted sense of humor, I guess. Yeah. And I kind of compare the show a bit to a very famous, world-famous format, Top Gear. Because you could say that Top Gear back in the day, was that a car show? Yeah, it was also a show about three friends sharing a passion. And it was basically their friendship you were watching always. Their teasing of each other, their wonderful, witty dialogue with each other that happened to focus on cars. But it could have focused on other things and it would have been, I would almost claim, just as popular because they were just super charming. And we, the fact that we are brothers and we share a passion, I think that makes people kind of, it's a family show. They don't necessarily go and cook the food that we're cooking, but they see it for the entertainment. So that is what it is. It is two brothers sharing a passion, which happens to be food.
Yeah. And that show has taken you to many places abroad, and it makes me think of just how busy of a man you are. So in that respect, how have you been able to finally tune your own criteria when selecting a project to take on? Because I presume you're constantly inundated with options and new ideas.
Yeah.
How have you fine-tuned that evaluation process of whether a project is worth pursuing?
I think people that are close to me would say he never found a way to fine-tune it. He's constantly fighting to get a grip because there's so many ideas and so many projects. And I'm basically driven by enthusiasm. That little flicker of hope we were talking about, the same optimism. I happen to be a time optimist as well, I'm afraid. So I always believe that the thing could be done in a shorter period of time than it usually takes, you know? So basically, I'm driven by enthusiasm and a joy of new ideas. And I'm very much a yes person that has had to learn how to say no. And I'm still learning, you know, because I am very enthusiastic and passionate about what I do. But I've had the amazing fortune of being able to work together with really brilliant people and being able to actually say, what am I good at in this process? And then trying to leave what I'm not good at to people that are brilliant at that. So again, those projects where we're actually doing it together, you know, I love those projects. I don't have any desire to do a lot of projects only me on my own. I have written some fiction, also prose, and I will probably still be doing that once in a while. But I love the, you know, the communal feeling of actually being a group of people that have a purpose and having the good fortune of meeting people that actually could make it possible to do as much and as varied stuff as I've been able to do. Now being a restaurateur and a TV chef, running a company, a production company, and writing material at the same time. I do also have a very tired assistant who works 24/7 to make all this happen. And I try really to cut away things that I'm not very good at and focus on the few talents I have and trying to become even better at them.
Hmm. Just as we draw to a close, Adam, is there a piece of art that you find yourself returning to time and time again for inspiration as you pursue your craft, be it musical, written, or otherwise?
Oh, yes, very much. But there would be many, I think. And I am actually very much inspired by great art. And sometimes it doesn't have to circulate around the same topic or what I'm trying to write or trying to break something around. I'm basically just thrilled by great talent. So sometimes when I'm to write a speech, I could read or listen to some of the great speeches, and it could be Shakespeare, could be Ibsen, but it could also be Aaron Sorkin, you know, one of the greatest screenwriters of our time, who has written such eloquent dialogue. And even though you can look at a show like West Wing and say, well, that has become almost too much fiction now because they are not this idealistic anymore. You don't have a president walking around speaking Latin to God anymore. Trump really put a punctuation mark in that sentence. So it has changed. The world has changed, but still those dialogues are amazing. I love to listen to that. And I listen to music. I listen to opera sometimes to kind of be elevated, you know, And I love instrumental concertos, the big piano or violin concertos. Sometimes I listen to a certain movement because I know that will put me in a certain mood. And then I will go directly to the computer and start writing. Sometimes it's completely foolish what I write, but still it is driven by passion. And passion is my fuel.
And just finally, Adam, has there been a specific moment where you felt deeply that your writing has hit its mark, where what you were attempting has truly landed, be it in the editing suite or on set or in rehearsals? I'm just curious if you've had that sense where you can really feel it and you know because you know because you know, a little bit like our friends of faith, that something you've written has achieved its full potential.
Well, I'm fortunate that I get that experience once in a while. Definitely not every day. Definitely there can be long, bleak spaces in between where I'm really searching and not finding. But as I said before, when you write drama, you are doing something together with other people. And what I write is not finished until you have experienced it on the screen, which is really interesting because it goes through so many people on the way. I only write a bit of the final work of art. But sometimes when you can really see that these words spoken by, it could be Cisse in Borgen, at that time, directed by this amazing director and set in motion by all these amazing people, other actors, the lighting, the DOP's work, everything kind of falls together, then I can be very touched. But it's not touched like, oh my God, I'm a great writer. It's just like, look what we've achieved together. That is so amazing. And I've had that experience many times. And I mean, the first speech that Birgitte Nyborg does in the first episode, we knew that we had the right actress for the right part. And we struck some kind of chord in time that inspired hope in many people. I've also had that experience on other things like Ride Upon the Storm, also sometimes desperate moments with Lars Mikkelsen, who is a very, very challenging actor because he constantly wants to correct the words. But sometimes when we arrived at a result together, he could just kick the ball so high into the air that it seemed to be a balloon and we could all board the balloon and being carried away on it. And we did this together, you know. It's such a feeling of relief and joy and gratitude, I would say. And those are the moments you live for and you want to achieve. And you don't do it every day. You don't do it every month. But if you just do it a few times, you are fueled by the same passion that drives me every day.
Well, that passion is indeed infectious. I thank you so much, Adam, for taking the time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Nordic Portraits is a series by me, Ben Catford. The music was composed by Nina Liu and the visual identity by Copenhagen-based studio Frame. To learn more about today's guest and all the others from this season, visit nordicportraits.net. You can also follow us on Instagram and remember to rate and subscribe on iTunes so we can get the word out. Thanks for listening.